KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oh, Redwood City, California.
Hayward.
Near Richmond.
I'm from Concord.
Martinez.
Hercules. I'm from Marina, California.
SF State, wherever that is.
Coming up, do African authors have to write immigrant stories to get published?
And the West is what you get for being good. If your protagonist works hard in their story and they get to live in the afterlife.
And what it's like being a Black writer when the overwhelming majority of publishers are white.
I'm writing about an older Black woman who is not poor, she's quite bourgeois. They think about their bottom line and they're like, not sure that this will sell.
We'll hear from three accomplished African authors and their struggles with the publishing industry. It's an episode of the podcast The Stoop coming up today on Cross Currents. Today, it's a special presentation of the podcast The Stoop, hosted by me and Leela Day. This episode is about the world of publishing. Who gets to choose which stories are told? And when you're Black, what kinds of stories will get you published in an overwhelmingly white publishing industry? We'll meet three writers, each of them pushing against the industry in their own way. It's the episode, The African Writer's Dilemma. Here we go.
The Stoop.
Stories from across the Black diaspora
that we need to talk about.
My cousins were water and grease girls, and I couldn't be a water and grease girl.
That's what I'm talking about, ballerina in the hood.
We be Gullah Geechee United people.
When a Black woman walks up to the desk in labor, what preconceived notions do you have about her?
I didn't even know we had a hair chart.
I'm over it. Immigrant literature.
This is Sianda Muhutsiwa. She's a writer from Botswana. She's 25 years old, obsessed with books since she was a little girl. She's pretty well known in African literary circles. She writes a lot, did a TED Talk on how young African writers are finding their voice on Twitter. And she wrote this controversial article a couple of years ago entitled, I'm Done with African Immigrant Literature.
It might have been somewhere in the middle of Teju Cole's open city as I followed his protagonists around the streets of New York. Or maybe it was at the end of No Violet Bulawayo's We Need New Names when I boarded the flight to America with its precocious star. Or perhaps it was a few weeks after finishing Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's Americana.
She says all these blockbuster books took her somewhere other than Africa. Mm-hmm. And they all felt like the same story. The fish out of water African trying to make it abroad. And it was getting to her.
All of this made me wonder why I had to read one more story about America or France or Britain. Actually, it made me furious.
Sianda says her boiling point came while she was standing at Johannesburg International Airport's bookstore one day.
I get to the bookstore, and first of all, there's a section in Africa, in an African bookstore, called African Literature. And this section, the main books that are on display are books in which the protagonists all move to the West at some point. So that frustrated me to no end, because I thought if I was not African and my first port of entry was Johannesburg and I wanted to get a book that introduced me to this continent and all the books are about my country, is that really the accurate representation of African literature? Is this really where we are right now?
Okay, so what does she mean, where we are right now, that these are all immigrant African books?
No, I think she's saying she just craved something different. You know, okay, so first of all, it's got to be said that we're talking about African literature, but really, we're talking about African books written in English. Since the continent is so diverse, a lot of writers write in English or in French, which most are familiar with because of colonization.
Mm-hmm. And so if you wrote a book in your specific language, only people from your own tribe or your own country would be able to understand it. So yeah. This sounds like a way just to make it more accessible.
Yeah. But then Sianda was noticing that all these English African books, they seem to be repeating this particular narrative over and over again, and not much else.
You move to a new country. You have all these dreams about your country. You find your subset of people who happen to be immigrants from your country. You have to keep up this facade about how well you're doing to the people back home. You send them a little money. Then after a few years, you stop sending them money. And this is every single immigrant story since the beginning of immigration.
First of all, that is so true.
Right? I was thinking, like, that sounds pretty accurate, right?
You know, and she says it felt like... like these writers had to be writing about Africans living in Europe or in the U.S.
And I wanted a book about Africa. I wanted a book about the continent that I've lived in my whole life. I call it the Western afterlife. The theme here is that Africa is some kind of earthly bound, I'm not going to say hellscape, but that's the idea. And the West is what you get for being good. So... If your protagonist works hard in their story and, you know, they get to go to the West, they get to live in the afterlife. It is like almost this like religious way of viewing Africa versus the West.
The Western afterlife.
Hallelujah.
And so what I dislike is people resting on their laurels or leaning on these tropes, on these stereotypes, on these old stories, and capitalizing on them, and that being the representation of African literature, which I don't think is right.
So she's saying the rest of the African story, right, the stories of Africans who do not leave Africa and who've lived on the continent their whole lives, you know, like the art scene in Accra or the tech boom in Nairobi, that those stories don't get told as much in the international literary scene. And that affects the global narrative about Africa. It paints this single picture that's incomplete, that everyone just wants to leave Africa.
Mm-hmm. And she mentions capitalizing on these stories.
Right.
We talked about earlier Chimamanda Adichie's Americana. Even before it got optioned for TV, it had sold 500,000 copies in its first 2 years in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So these types of stories, they're popular, you know?
Very popular. And they're being written all the time. So the question is, does African writing have to be in the form of immigrant stories to sell and to be that popular globally?
I mean, it clearly doesn't. That's what's so strange to me about this, is that Chinua Achebe wrote Things Fall Apart, and that was quite big.
Achebe's Things Fall Apart is often required reading for colleges all around the world. Did you read it in college?
Not in college, after college. And Chimamanda Adichie, two other popular books she wrote, Half of a Yellow Sun and Purple Hibiscus, they were based in Nigeria.
So it's not necessary. So that's what's frustrating to me, is that I know it is possible to do well in the West and back home writing characters who are home.
Then Sienda gets into what she sees as the real issue at the center of all of this. The world's biggest publishers are mostly not in Africa. They're in the U.S. and the U.K., targeting readers in those countries.
Readers with British pounds and U.S. dollars.
Hello, cha-ching.
And that's what makes it so clear that people have to dance to the tune of these Western publishers. If they tell you to trump up the section about moving to America, or if they say, you know, this doesn't really appeal, then people often, if your main motivation is to just be a successful writer and not to write something that's going to outlive you, not to write something that's from your soul, if it's just to get onto the bestsellers list, you will dance to any tune. And if the tune is Make America Heaven, The Afterlife, then that's what you're going to do. And it's unfortunate.
It kind of sounds like she's throwing some shade at these authors.
She says she doesn't mean to diss any authors. You know, she says she's commenting on a genre.
Yes, I respect what contemporary authors are trying to do, share their experiences. But African literature cannot move forward with the most celebrated authors writing about Europe.
But it did sound like a diss to many people. Kasianda got some major pushback. Her article was critiqued, and a lot of people were pissed.
Oh, goodness gracious. So the article got me basically crucified on Twitter, metaphorically. I didn't expect that, but I wasn't surprised.
So Hannah, this question about publishers is so important. Mm-hmm. Who publishes your book has a lot to do with the end product of what story gets told. So it sounds like a writer has a decision to make. Who am I writing for to get this book published? Mm-hmm. Who's my audience? It's a thing Black American writers face here too.
Well, it's interesting because in 2016, Pew Research counted American, Black, and White book readers. They found 76% of white people said they read a book in the previous year. For Black people, that number was 69%.
That's just a 7% difference. It's about the same.
Yeah.
There's a big white readership, and there's also a big Black readership. So writers can write for whoever they want to.
Yeah, theoretically, but the thing is the publishers aren't diverse. A 2015 survey showed just about 80% of publishing staff in the U.S. are white. About 7% Asian, Native, Pacific Islander, about 5% Hispanics, Mexicans, and just 3.5% of publishers are Black.
So there's two things here. Having a diverse staff in a publishing company can make a difference in not only how a story gets told, but what they actually think will sell.
Yeah, and that determines what we all read. You're listening to The African Writer's Dilemma, a special episode of Cross Currents featuring the podcast The Stoop.
Okay, so I'll read the first paragraph of the book.
This is Sarah Ladipo Manyika, a Nigerian-British author who lives in San Francisco.
And this is with my main character, Morayo Da Silva.
She wrote two novels and a novella. Her latest is called Like a Mule Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun.
Oh my gosh, that is the best title ever.
Right?
I'm hungry and I want to ride.
It's about this retired professor, Morayo, who's aging in San Francisco on her own.
She is from Nigeria originally, but she's led something of a very cosmopolitan life. She was at one point married to an ambassador, so she has lived in India, La France, un peu partout. Voila.
Morayo is worried about the big one, the anticipated huge earthquake coming to the city.
I'd like to imagine that when the big one strikes, we'd all be gathered at my place, enjoying a glass of Sauvignon Blanc, and we'd ride the whole thing out and live to tell the tale. But who knows, when the earth finally decides that it's tired of fidgeting and needs a proper stretch, I might be the one walking downstairs. And if that's the case, then the only survivors will be my books, hundreds of them, to keep each other company.
First of all, I gotta say, from now on, I'm going to pronounce it Sauvignon Blanc.
How did you pronounce it?
Sauvignon Blanc.
Ugh. Girl.
Anyway, so Sarah's story is about an immigrant Nigerian in the West, Siyanda Muhutsiwa's pet peeve.
Yeah, Sarah has some thoughts about what Siyanda wrote about immigrant novels.
What I would say to her is, fine, I understand the fed-upness on that front, but let's start raising the voices of those who are writing different kinds of stories. Let's start supporting publishers within Nigeria, Zimbabwe, where have you.
And she's been thinking about this whole publishing question a lot. Her American publishers were giving her the runaround when she wrote books that didn't fit their vision of the African story, like her novel Independence.
I remember various people coming back and saying, we like the story, but it's a love story. We're not sure that we can sell, that this will sell easily. The same thing for Like a Mule Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun. I'm writing about an older Black woman who is not poor, she's quite bourgeois, and I've also written a novella. And so the publishing industry, publishers, agents, you know, they think about their bottom line and they're like, not sure that this will sell.
So Sarah Manyika was just sick of the U.S. publisher drama, and she made this daring decision. She was going to publish not in the U.S., where she lives, but she was going to publish through a Nigerian publisher called Cassava Republic. And there's this article she wrote for The Guardian about why she made that choice. And she said Cassava was, quote, unencumbered by some of the stereotypes of what so-called African literature should look like. They were able to think creatively and offer fresh ideas.
Okay. So in other words, they were free. They were free.
Mm-hmm.
They were free from the ideas of the mostly white U.S. and U.K. publisher opinions. And she could tell her story the way she wanted to. And nobody would tell her what won't sell and what would sell.
Right. And in the process, we, the readers, would all get a book that was more authentic, you know, right down to the book cover.
They have a different way, for example, about thinking about book covers. I'm not going to have a tree or a bare-torsoed young child or, you know, all these or a sunset or some all these kind of stereotypes of Africa. I can have an abstract painting or something that is different, thinking out of the box, that doesn't have to fall into the cliches, the stereotypes that have been established.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I like that. I like the abstract, thinking out of the book.
Yeah.
But I gotta say, Hana, I don't have anything wrong with the trees and the sunsets.
Mm-mm.
I mean, do you look at those book covers and think this is totally cliche?
It's just too much. It's just not every book has to have all of these Sudanese books, for example. And it's always the tree and it's always the plant and it's always the woman wearing, you know, a big old scarf. And that's beautiful and that's fine, but not all the time.
Okay.
You want some abstract art too?
But I mean, this is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It gets into who the product is being marketed to, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this has come up with us even on our podcast with The Stoop.
Yes, it has.
You know, who is our audience? Who are we talking to? We were asked that so much.
And
we're still asked that.
All the time.
Right?
All the time. Who are you talking to?
Mm-hmm.
Like, who are you addressing?
I was recently speaking to a friend, a podcaster, white guy, amazing artist. And I told him how we had to think so much about our audience because we were asked that so much. Who is your audience?
All the time.
Yes. People wondering what we were doing. They were asking us this question.
Right.
And he said, I never even thought about that question when I was making my podcast.
So it was never an issue. Nobody ever asked him that.
No, he said he never even thought about it. And he also said, if I was to think about that, I think it would compromise how I would make my art. And I said, exactly. Well, that's what happens when you start thinking about who your audience is so much. It starts to change what you're making. And this is what these women are saying, these writers.
Right. And that's what kind of pushes you then away from this, you know, quote unquote mainstream, right? It's like, well, I'm going to start doing my own thing then. You know, if you keep asking me over and over again, who are you writing to? Who are you writing to? And this audience question, and you're not happy if I say, well, you know, I don't know, or I haven't thought of audience because I want to say what I want to say,
mm-hmm.
right? I want to write how I want to write.
Yeah.
If that's not being accepted as an answer, then people just go and do their own thing on their own.
Yeah. And there's this really small space that large companies have carved out for Black content.
Yeah.
We know that.
We do.
Because there was a comment that we got in the podcasting world, which was, it seems like a really crowded space for two Black women in podcasting.
We're too many, Leela.
Can you believe, do you remember when that happened?
I remember it. I didn't know what to say. They were like, isn't there already a podcast with two Black women hosts?
Yeah. I mean, that burned us.
Yeah, it did. It was disappointing.
So it's like,
It was enraging. It made me angry, but it also is disappointing. So as much as we'd all love for the playing ground to be equal, it just pushes us to create our own damn spaces. And that's what Cassava Republic Publishing did.
It's the BET of publishing.
It is. And it was a huge success with African writers on the continent over there. And now they're opening up a U.S. branch.
Okay.
So Americans here will buy books published in Africa by Africans.
Okay.
And Sarah Manyika, she just loves it.
I'm sure she does.
Her book Independence was one of the first three that Cassava published here in the U.S. branch. But before that, it had already sold 3 million copies in Africa.
Girl!
I know.
Never expected that, and that's not going to happen to everybody. But I give that example as illustration of the fact that we shouldn't always be looking to the so-called West to be the place where you make it, or where you arrive, or where you become a bestseller, or where you win prizes. There are prizes all over the world now. And so I think it's also on us to stop thinking about America and Europe as the be-all and end-all for publishing. It isn't.
So Hannah, Sarah mentions the prizes don't just come from the US or the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But when writers are published and then recognized and given honors or awards, does it even matter where these awards come from?
Hell to the yes, according to Zambian novelist Namwali Serpell.
I'm an associate professor of English at UC Berkeley and a fiction writer.
So in 2015, Namwali won the prestigious Kane Award for African Writing for her short story, The Sack. So the Kane Prize, it's known as Africa's leading literary award. Huge, huge deal. But she had issues with the award. First of all, it's based in England.
And you go to the British Library. The award ceremony is at the Bodleian at Oxford. You're given a tour of the House of Lords because it was originated by Sir Michael Caine, whose wife is in the House of Lords. It's a very elaborate and in certain ways kind of colonially tinged endeavor. And I was feeling very annoyed by it.
And I don't blame her, because when you come from a place that was colonized by the British, this is the last way you want to be celebrated.
By the British.
By the British, in that very British way.
And so there was an event at the British Library where we were asked, you know, how do you feel about the Kane Prize being administered in London? We were asked by, it was a bunch of different book clubs, African book club, Black British book club. Like, so lots of Black Brits and, you know, readers in this room asking five African writers, so why are y'all here exactly? And so I raised my hand and I said, I asked this question too. Why do we go to Oxford? Why is this prize here? You know, they're like, why not have it in Lagos 1 year, Cape Town another year, you know, Cairo, Lusaka, just a different African city every year. Why not do that? And the Kane Prize administrator at the time raised their hand and responded, because this is where the money is.
Oh, can you believe that? That's where the money is.
Well, I can kind of see what he's saying.
What?
I mean, I can get it. He's saying that's where the money is. That's where the event is being held. So what's the problem here? That's where the money is, so...
No, that's not the point. That's where the money is. And it's kind of like, but it's coming from these British people. There's a complicated, complex history with Africa, with colonization. And you're bringing me here to give me the award, and you're giving me this... You're putting me in this week of Britishness. And then you tell me, well, this is where the money is. And there's this feeling of, like... This is a favor you're giving me, you know, and you know, and there's this feeling of, well, all of this money that you have, kind of, you know, the history of it is.
It's tainted. But if this award ceremony was
tainted.
In South Africa or in Sudan, and it was the same money, but in a different place, would that make it any different?
That's her point. That's her point. Make it in a different place, not England,
okay.
And not in this way.
Bring your money to us.
Bring your money to us. You took it before.
So what'd she do?
And that was my inspiration for actually splitting the prize when I won.
She split her prize money with the other writers?
Yes.
Okay.
I thought of it as a kind of rebellion, as a way of saying, listen, if the reason you're going to continue to have this prize come out of England and be structured in this way is because of the money, then I'm going to show you that actually the money is not the most important thing to us writers.
Boom!
Okay,
She told them.
I know, they did not expect that.
Mm-mm.
A former prize judge walked up to me with tears in her eyes and said, "I can't believe you did that. That was amazing."
You've been listening to The African Writer's Dilemma, a special episode of Cross Currents featuring the podcast The Stoop, hosted by me and Leela Day. KLW's Jen Chien was editor, engineering by Seth Samuel, music by Daoud Anthony and Mazen Jamal. Support for The Stoop comes from California Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Find them at calhum.org. And you can find more episodes featuring stories from across the Black diaspora at thestoop.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Emma McAvoy, Marissa Shea, and Marco Seiler Gonzalez. Our Cross Currents engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Shireen Adil is our content manager. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune in tomorrow at 5. It's our 10th anniversary, and we're celebrating. 10 years of Cross Currents. Can you believe it? That's tomorrow at 5 from KLW News. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.